the Beatles were lucky. There were four of them, so no matter how insane it got, and from all accounts, it got pretty insane, they always had somebody else who was going through the same thing to get a reality check from. By their own admission, it helped dilute some of the madness, and they were able to emerge from their fabness relatively unscathed. Well, except for that whole getting shot by your biggest fan nonsense, but that wasn't John's fault. He never thought he was God. Elvis and Michael Jackson weren't so lucky. They had to ride the eye of their hurricanes alone. And clearly, they both went insane because of it. Growing up, I was certainly aware of who Michael Jackson was. I'd occasionally see the Jackson 5 TV show on Saturday mornings, but I didn't really care. He had a good voice and all, but that whole R&B soul thing didn't really do much for me, mostly still doesn't, so I didn't pay much attention to him. Even after Off the Wall came out and flooded the market, I didn't pay him much attention. Although, I must admit, I did buy the single of She's Out of My Life, but only for the opening string line.
She's out of my life. Out of my life, and I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I don't know whether to live or die, and it cuts like a out of my life.
Shortly after I brought it home, I discovered the song was greatly improved by playing the 45 at 33 RPMs.
It's out of my hands.
His voice is so solid on that recording that it sounds good at any speed. It almost makes him sound like a man.
She's out of my life. Indecision and cursed pride. I kept my love for her locked deep inside, and it cuts like a knife. She's out of
the other tracks were okay. I mostly didn't mind when they came on the radio, but it didn't make me want to buy it, and most of the time I found Michael Jackson quite easy to ignore. But Thriller changed all that. Thriller came out while I was doing penance at the University of Chicago, and I remember idly looking at it in the record racks one day that spring.
Every night she walks right in my dreams. Since I met her from the start, I'm so proud I am the only one who is special in her heart. The girl is mine. The doggone girl is mine.
There wasn't a chance I was going to buy it, but there was something intriguing about it. I can't say I was particularly impressed with the early singles, including an obnoxious duet with Paul McCartney.
I don't understand the way you think, saying that she's yours, not mine. Sending roses and your silly dreams, really just a waste of time, because she's mine. The doggone girl is mine.
But there was an enormous amount of buzz building up around the album.
Don't waste your time.
It must have been enormous if it reached all the way to my lonely dorm room on the south side, a cell with no radio. When I finally made it out of that hellhole, I ran back home to Interlaken to help my former classmates celebrate their graduation. Eric, being a year younger than I, was graduating, and we had plans to move to New York City together that summer. I watched his year-end performance with an enormous amount of emotion and burst into tears backstage after it was all over. It was such a mix of feelings: glad the Chicago ordeal was over, glad to be back in the land of the living with people who valued the same things I did, but also enormously sad and lost at the giant hole that cutting dance out of my life had left. I knew I didn't really want to pursue the life of a dancer. Not only wasn't I ultimately good enough, I was more a performer than a technician, and technique ruled in the big city. But I also didn't have the drive. I didn't care enough to really make a go of it. But the hole it tore out of my life was enormous, and it would take a couple of years to find something that could begin to fill it up. Recovering my composure, I met my pals after dinner and we went out to make the year-end party rounds. First stop, a dance at the outdoor Kresge Auditorium, which was only officially used once during the school year, and that was for the upcoming commencement. The dance was its usual good time, and I was glad to be in a situation where I could dance to my heart's delight in any style and with anybody that I desired and not get any shit for it, unlike in Chicago, where I used to get phone threats for dancing the way I did. I shuddered at the thought of my recent incarceration and turned my attention back to the matter at foot. A song I had never heard came on, and a roar went through the crowd. Even though I had never heard it, in a few measures I knew what it was. I had heard about this particular song and the controversy it had sparked, and listening to the mix of mechanized beats and flame-throwing guitar, I knew right away that this was Beat It. It's hard to remember that Beat It was a controversial song, but at the time it raised quite a few objections. Not so much for the lyrical content. Who but hardcore gangbangers could really object to a song encouraging you not to get the shit beat out of you, but because of its musical content. At that time, 1983, black music and white music were two distinctly different camps, and rarely did the twain intertwine. Michael Jackson was clearly a black artist, not so much for the color of his skin, or rather, what the color of his skin used to be, but because of the musical idioms he pursued. Soul, R&B, light funk, urban contemporary, those were all clearly delineated black musical forms, and although they certainly got play on pop radio, it was generally accepted and expected that those forms would stay in their community. Separate but equal, you might say. By the same token, Eddie Van Halen was a white musician, not so much because of the color of his skin, but because he was the lead guitarist in one of the biggest pop metal bands in the country, and all stripes of metal, pop, heavy, death, speed, whatever, were white musical forms. They were also expected to ultimately stay in their neighborhoods. And now here's Michael Jackson inviting Eddie Van Halen to spice up one of his tracks. And here's Eddie actually doing it, and doing it in his own heavy metal style, neither artist giving an inch. As a white kid, you could profess a fondness for certain black musical forms, Motown in particular, as long as you tempered it with enough Eagles or Led Zeppelin or David Bowie or the Beatles or whatever. And I'm sure the same thing was probably true if you grew up black. The only music that really crossed color lines, as far as performers went, was disco. And that was widely reviled as fag music, and once the disco craze had burned out, it too was relegated to its cultural ghetto. What with all that's transpired in the 20-plus years since Thriller came out, it's hard to appreciate just how cutting-edge it was, but Thriller in general, and Beat It in particular, was a revolution in music. Mixing these two icons on one track was quite a gambit, and it almost blew up in their face. Instead, it worked perfectly, and the walls came tumbling down. What Stevie Wonder had suggested on Ebony and Ivory, Jackson put into practice, and it worked beautifully.
Black stations, white stations, break down the doors. Stand up and face the music, this is 1984. Black stations, white stations, beat on the floor. Dance on the ceiling with us, this is 1984.
By uniting these two musical icons and forms in one blistering dance track, Jackson brought the whole world together, and he was ultimately rewarded by becoming the biggest pop star in the universe. I knew, on hearing Beat It, that Michael Jackson had done something special, but the full impact of Thriller had yet to be felt. Beat It was merely the tip of the iceberg. I stayed home at Interlaken for about a month before our planned departure for the Big Bad Apple, and during that time, my friend Alan, who had graduated the year before me, and who, in Ace, was the A to my C and Eric's E, tried to convince me to stay and form a band with him. He had recently switched from tuba to electric bass, and thought we could make a run of it. I couldn't play anything but a little piano, but we wrote a few tunes together and practiced them a bit and had a brief fantasy of being rock stars. If ever there was a time when a keyboard player and a bassist could make a go of it, it was in the early 80s. But ultimately, I knew it would go nowhere, and I really needed to get out of Interlaken. My year in Chicago had been an unmitigated failure, and I needed to get back in the saddle again right away or risk getting stuck in rural Michigan forever. And I just couldn't see that happening. Besides, the adventure that living in New York City with Eric offered was too great to resist. Alan conceded that he knew how things were going to play out, but he still had to give it a shot, for which I was grateful. The fact that he had such confidence in my musical abilities, based on nothing more than a handful of awkward tunes I'd managed to bang out on the piano, was inspiring. But I just wasn't band material. Years later, I'd have to learn that lesson again. Anyway, I grabbed Eric's hand, and we both ran for the edge of the abyss and jumped over into our new adventure, not sure where or how we'd land, but confident we'd be all right. And that summer and fall, Thriller just kept growing and growing. Each single released was bigger than the one before, and the album just seemed unstoppable. There were months during that year when you couldn't go outside of the apartment, or stay in it really, without hearing the slinky, chugging beat of Billie Jean pouring from every window and stoop and car that drove by. The popularity of Thriller was astonishing. For a few months there, the legacy of Beat It played itself out, and everybody wanted to be Michael Jackson. Rich, poor, young, old, black, white, green, yellow, everybody thought that Jackson was the man. It didn't matter what kind of music you usually listened to, punk, new wave, opera, country, there was nobody that thought Thriller was anything but amazing. I didn't buy my copy for a couple years after that because I didn't need to. I heard more songs from Thriller more times than I heard anything I actually owned, just by being part of the city at that time. But I happily joined the ranks of the 26 or however many million people shelled out money for that album. Michael would sneeze, and it would make the front cover of every magazine and newspaper in the world. The oldsters nodded their head and muttered, Beatlemania, or just like Elvis, but I certainly had never seen anything like it. There had been stars, but Michael Jackson was something else entirely. He was his own constellation. I remember when the video for Thriller, the song, came out. Now, Thriller is a pretty weak song, but that didn't matter in the least. There was so much momentum behind that album that a recording of Jackson farting would have topped the charts. And while Thriller was no great song, the video broke all conceptions of what a music video was and what it could accomplish.
Oh,
Sam Goody's in Times Square set up a big television monitor in the window and played the half-hour video on a tape loop day and night when it was released. And it didn't matter what time you were there, you had to cross the street if you wanted to get by, so large were the crowds pressed up against the window. Michael Jackson was beyond popular, and the crush of humanity desperately pressed up against that window eventually made him crazy. Although, through the long lens of hindsight, there are some bad tracks on the album. PYT isn't so hot, and the aforementioned duet with Paul McCartney, The Girl Is Mine, is fun for a few listens, but then overstays its welcome, and Baby Be Mine just plain sucks. Thriller is a remarkably solid album, and may well deserve to be the best-selling album of all time. There's some debate about this, as the Eagles' Greatest Hits has, I believe, actually sold more copies, but I don't think it really counts. That's a collection of hits from many different albums, whereas Thriller was a single album prepared and released at one moment. Despite the popularity and undeniable charm of Billie Jean and Beat It, my favorite track on the disc is the lead-off cut, Wannabe Starting Something. I love the stuttery beat and the way it opens up the album and sets the stage for a new paradigm in pop music with three short drum beats, very much like the way Talking Heads fired its Remain in Light salvo 3 years earlier. Tribal beat is propulsive and the snaky guitars suck you in. Plus, it has to be one of the strangest songs in his canon. People who wonder when Michael Jackson started coming undone need look no further than this track. Although, I suppose you could point to his touching love song, Ben, sung to a rat, as early evidence of a mind wandering off the beaten path. Something about being too big to get around, these lyrics are very much like the stolen preacher's rant from Brian Eno and David Byrne's Help Me Somebody, and babies starving to death and rumors blowing up out of proportion and believing in yourself, or something like that. And then it gets really weird. He repeats over and over again, you're a vegetable, while also throwing in that they hate you, you're just a buffet, and they eat off of you. After bewildering hee-haw, the song shifts into its final stretch with a nonsensical refrain in which he implores you to help me sing it, Mama say, Mama sa, Mama ku sa. I once heard a rumor that half of the background vocals during that section were saying the nonsense syllables, and half of them were actually saying, I was saved by the sound of Michael's song. But I don't really think that's true. Still, I'm happy to pass it along for your consideration.
Mama.
After the phenomenon of Thriller finally burned itself out, there was nowhere for Jackson to go but down. And down he went, spiraling into his overpublicized madness, mutilation, and perversion. His album still sold well, but one needed look no further than the titles to see him flailing for help. Bad. Dangerous.
Your word is mine, won't take you right. Just show your face, broad daylight. I'm telling you, on how I feel. Gonna catch your mind, don't you dare. Jump on, jump on, get on me.
It seems clear to me that Michael Jackson has gone insane. I certainly can't condone his pedophilia, if indeed he's guilty of that. It's a horrible, heinous, damaging crime. But I also can't help but feel sorry for him. With that level of scrutiny and public pressure, and with the stories of his overbearing father and his lack of any kind of childhood, who could he possibly turn to? Who could he trust? He was all alone in the spotlight, and he couldn't crawl away even for a moment. No wonder he created Neverland, but even the name shows he knew it was an unreachable fantasy. Inside that damaged shell, it's curled a poor, sad little boy with enormous talent and unbearable pressures. He's been crying out for a long time, before Thriller even, although the seeds of unhappiness and paranoia, listen to the words of Billie Jean for further proof, started sprouting up on that monumental, world-changing album, one of the greatest pop icons ever created.
She's out of my life.
But fans don't care for the troubles of stars, even if they're jumping up and down and begging for it. Look at John Lennon and Help. Could any message be clearer or more willfully ignored? So it was with Jackson, telling the world he was bad, he was dangerous, he was a vegetable, a buffet that fed the world that hated him. But did anybody hear him? Of course not. How could they, over their own bloodthirsty, idolizing screams?
Deep inside, and it cuts like a knife. She's out.